shares, market,
the S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that says vote one Motley Fool. That's right, it's election season for all of our sins, once every 3 years. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, is Dr. Anir Bhanmahanti. G'day, Doc.
G'day, Captain.
How are you, bud?
I'm electionified.
Oh, electionified. I love it. Mate, I'm thinking we should start a Motley Fool party. What do you reckon?
Oh, I think it's great. Who's standing, though?
Oh, you and I, for starters.
Okay. I'll let you stand.
No, you can do it, too.
Okay.
You can be our information economy minister.
That sounds like good.
You like that?
Yeah,
let's see. You're in already.
Yeah, I can make a contribution.
See, we've already got two members for the party, mate. Will Porter, our producer, will absolutely join along, and the three of us will start the Motley Fool party. By this time tomorrow, mate, there'll be still three members. But we'll do it.
Maybe more.
Vote one Motley Fool. Hashtag Motley Fool Party if you're listening and you want to join the party on Twitter. This is officially not an official party and there is no, you know, authorised buy and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, hit us up on Twitter. Hashtag Motley Fool Party. See how many we can get going. You know what? By this time next week, we are actually standing for an election. That'd be kind of fun.
That would be great.
What do you reckon the boss would say?
I don't want to venture even into guessing.
All right. Other than that, on this week's podcast, we will talk the election very briefly, but stay with us. We promise it won't be too long. We'll talk about the RBA's view on rates and what the market thinks as well. We'll talk about our banks. Bank of Queensland, BOQ, reported earnings this week, and it was not pretty. We'll talk about winners and losers. There's a pun there. We'll get to that in a minute.
Mm.
And another twist in the tale for Wesfarmers Alliance. I mean, I wasn't even following this that particularly closely, but you gave me a heads up this morning that there's some stuff going on, including with the corporate cops. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. And if we have time, we will dip into the full mailbag. Let's get on with it.
Let's do it.
Mate, what do we say? So yesterday morning, so we're recording this on Friday morning, as we always do, or almost always. Yesterday morning, Scott Morrison jumped in the government BMW, the company car, headed down to Yarralumla. Knocked on the Governor-General's door and said, Sir Peter, I'd like you to call an election, which is all that needs to happen. That's going to happen. The writs will be issued. All that good, fun Senate stuff happens. I'm kind of a politics nerd, so I've got to say, as much as I pretend I don't like it, I'm kind of, you know, excited about the whole thing. I do like my politics. I'll be watching closely on election night as the tallies come through, the wins and losses. It's kind of my thing. Not necessarily everybody's thing, though. Question for you. Where do investors get the best read on the election? And do we, or should we, really care?
Well, so I'm not a big fan of elections like you are, largely because they sound more like a shouting contest to me. You know,
so you're not going to join me for the Motley Fool Politics podcast?
Well, I will, but I'd rather not be part of a shouting contest. And, my policy, and no, that policy is wrong and rubbish. You know, they're both rubbish.
That sounds familiar.
So I mean, most newspapers cover politics, right?
Me too.
I mean, SMH or you know, the Fin,
Age, Courier Mail,
the Fin, the Age, Sun. They all have it. You know, if you have Twitter, I'm sure Twitter will give you.
Already does, yes.
Yeah, you know, there'll probably be a hashtag for the Aussie election. So lots of ways to follow it. It's important and not important at the same time. I mean, you know, it's important because the government, or the government of the day, can make decisions and does make decisions that impact investing, all types of investing, right? It impacts not just share investing, property investing, investing in bonds and everything, right?
All the good stuff.
All the good stuff. And it doesn't matter in the sense that, you know, there's one government for 3 years, sometimes actually less than 3 years.
That's true.
And then the next one comes and it makes some decisions, right? So you can't really predict, you know, into the future what's going to happen. There's a bit of a, I like to see what they do, but I don't, you know, consider.
Without asking you to declare your hand, because we won't talk politics necessarily, at least we won't talk voting. Do you consider each party's investing implications as you go to the polls?
Yes and no. Yes and no, in the sense that, you know, I like certain policies are more favorable to long-term investing, right? So, for example, if you are reducing selfishly, from my own point of view, if I'm investing money, I like the capital gains tax benefit. Like, I mean, it's a great benefit to have, right? If that gets cut, you know, I feel the pinch, and I'm sure all investors feel the pinch, right? But at the same time, I get the view that, you know, who's investing? Well, you know, the people who can afford to invest, and therefore there's a class and group of people who are not able to invest and who therefore need the society's support, and therefore, if we take money from these guys. But I mean, you can make all sorts of arguments, right? There's an argument that you should tax the rich or tax the people who are making more money. But I can also make an argument that, you know, you if you tax the people who are working hard, then they will stop working hard. And is that actually useful, you know? So there's all sorts of discussion. Maybe there should be a minimum wage that you guarantee to people and then basically have a flat tax, for everyone. That, you know, if, basically that says that there's nobody's going to be disadvantaged, but those people who want to work hard get to work hard, right? Without being penalized in some sense for working hard, right? Yep. So I do consider it, like, I mean, you know, it's a difficult decision to make. Personally, when I go to vote, without, you know, saying how, you know, I often actually look at just the local candidate. And my vote is often actually not decided by what's happening actually at the federal level, but rather who the candidate is, right? Okay. And, you know, if I like the candidate and, you know, I think that they're going to make some difference to my electorate, then I vote for that candidate, irrespective of what I actually think about. That's how I've voted in the past. That's how I vote actually even in the local elections, right? Instead of actually considering what, you know, Scott Morrison or Bill Shorten are going to do. You know, and I've actually, you know, made up my mind this time how I'm going to vote. I haven't.
Oh, you haven't?
I have not.
There you go. Stay tuned, fools. We definitely won't be talking about that.
But you have not. But, you know, that's why I said, you know, again, it depends on who the local candidate is going to be and what they're saying. So.
Nice one. Very good. We may or may not cover some of the policies that later in the month, mate, as we get closer to the election. If our listeners want to hear about them, we're happy to kind of go through them, not to give a judgment necessarily, but just to, I guess, cover those ones that matter for investors, as we are an investing podcast. The only thing I would say broadly for our listeners is to think about not just the first order, but also the second order consequences. So second order thinking is a thing that's, I mean, maybe we should do a podcast about second order thinking at one point, Doc, but the idea is basically the first order thinking is what happens immediately. So if I do a thing, what's, you know, the equal opposite reaction that, is it Newton would have said? We think about that. Now, that's true in a very simplistic sense. In life, because we're, you know, society is a complex series of feedback loops. There are often second and third order impacts. In other words, if I do a thing, something else happens immediately, but what else does that create, or what happens after that? So, for example, one key element would be, as an investor, you know, do I want to pay less or more tax on my capital gains? Well, that's a meaningful question. The bigger question, though, is if I'm going to be investing for the next 25 years, what set of policies are most likely to generate the sorts of conditions that maximize the profits made by the companies I own, for example, that actually may be a larger impact than the capital gains tax changes, or may not? And that's kind of one of those second order impacts, right? So the same thing with wage increases, you mentioned, is a good one, right? So people say, well, you know, if I pay more tax and other people get paid more money, then I lose out. That can be true. The second order impact might be that if lower paid workers get more money, then they may spend more money. It actually might mean my companies make more profit. So it's kind of one of those questions, and that may not be true as well, by the way. There's a counterfactual for everything. But it's worth thinking about those second order impacts as you think about how you might vote. And of course, like most people, we'll also be considering more than just the investment angle when we personally vote. This podcast, we may cover the investment implications just because that's our job. But we'll see how we go as we get closer to the date. That's enough on elections, isn't it?
That's on. I think so.
Thank goodness.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, I said that's enough on elections, and that was true. The problem is now we're going to talk about the RBA.
I love talking about RBA.
Well,
it's a government body, but fairly neutral.
I'm not entirely
neutral.
Sure that our listeners want to listen to us talk about the RBA, is my concern. But we have a responsibility to do the right thing, and so you mentioned kind of some of the bigger impact issues, right? The RBA is maybe the largest lever when it comes to policy right across the political and kind of regulatory spectrum. Governments change things here and there, but when the RBA either pulls or pushes that interest rate lever, that has wide-ranging ramifications and a lot of ripples, right? The old rock in the pond thing. The RBA I don't know if it's just me, there's a really loud chorus of people who are saying, the RBA should cut rates, I should cut them now, we know best. Mm. And they've kind of been ranting for a while. And the RBA has been stubbornly, or maybe just ignoring them altogether, just simply going along its merry way, not cutting rates. It's like, well, there's risks, but yeah, well, things might be okay. They've been what we like to call in the trade dovish. Hawkish would be they're taking decisive action to make some changes to cut rates, to do some good things. Dovish is kind of letting just things play out a little bit longer, not taking big kind of, you know, impactful actions. To some level, the RBA have been incredibly dovish. They've been really reticent to cut rates any further, despite the growing chorus of people who are really keen for them to do so and getting louder and louder in their provocations. And right now, at least, the market, I wouldn't say necessarily agrees, because it's the market's job to anticipate the RBA rather than to pass judgment. But right now, both the RBA is seeming pretty relaxed, and the market has basically removed any chance. There's a whole lot of pricing mechanisms we won't go into, because it'll bore me to tears and bore our listeners even more. Basically, the market, the short-term money market on different maturities, so if you're putting your money over 3 or 6 or 9 months, the rate you get is the market's best guess as to where rates would be by then, because they're trying to match those off, right? So if the official cash rate's going to be lower by then, you'll get a lower rate. It's going to be higher by then, you get a higher rate. The market had been pricing in 1 or 2 rate cuts, one potentially before the election, or certainly straight after. That's gone effectively to zero, those chances, according to the market. So at least investors are kind of picking up what the RBA is laying down, if I can use that horrible expression to make myself sound like I'm 14 again. Everything seems to be okay.
Yeah, you know, as much as I would criticize both political parties for, and I hate this bringing politics back, you know, I love what the RBA does. You know, it's as a central banker,
yeah,
their job is to look at data and make data-based decisions.
As a scientist, that really floats your boat.
And it really makes me happy.
Awesome.
That they actually do that job really, really well. Right? I mean, you know, they look at the data and say, oh, you know, okay, the economy is not growing at a super fast rate, mm-hmm, but it's not shrinking.
Yeah.
It you know, okay, people were not buying many cars a couple of months back, but hey, they're back to buying cars, right? Mm-hmm. So the economy is doing just fine. And, you know, anybody who expects the Australian economy is going to grow at like 5% is then, you know, is just being...
Donald Trump.
Well, even Donald Trump wouldn't expect the Australian economy to, you know, he only said 4% or 3.5% or something like that, right? So 5% is like, you know, the economy is doing fine. And if anything, I would say the RBA should have continued with increasing, or should have followed the other central banks in increasing rates,
right?
Which would have given them more firepower if we land up in a trouble, mm-hmm, or in a spot that, yeah, we don't want to be. So I think RBI is doing the right thing. I think the market was just being, and RBI has come out and said that, you know, the house price decline hasn't had that kind of impact, which people thought would have. Right?
That's the whole wealth effect thing. The orthodoxy was supposed to be that as prices fell, people feel poorer, they stop spending, exactly, the economy goes into a tailspin. So far, at least, touch wood,
that hasn't happened. So I love the fact that they're following the data, and you know, following the data is the right thing to do here. You know, what would you, if you cut the rates further, I mean, you know, it's going to again go back to creating the same sort of spiral, and then you'd have no room for firepower. So, you know, when the RBA needs it, I think it's great. I think the RBA is doing a fantastic job. I love it.
I completely agree with you, mate. Greg McKenna, who's a very smart bloke, who's on Sky with me occasionally, or Your Money, as they call it now, was saying the same thing. He reckons the RBA is one of the best central banks in the world. Like, I actually completely agree. I think they've done a really good job of not bowing to pressure from any angle, whether that be the rate cut brigade or the rate increase brigade or the anyone brigade, and saying, look, we're going to do what's right for the economy. Thankfully for them, they don't have the same pressure of Jerome Powell in the US, who has the president yelling at him every month. But in any case, they've still got the sense of, you know, independence, and they seem to be doing, we won't know until, the hard part about central banking is you don't know until after the fact whether it's right or wrong. Mm. As you said, we should explain the firepower thing. So the idea basically is that if and when the economy gets into trouble, the central bank can lower rates potentially very quickly, mm-hmm, to either stimulate the economy or simply just slow the decline. So to the extent that people start to get worried, the RBA says, we're here, we're taking action. And that's as much a confidence as a real economy thing, to my mind, I think, Doc, I have to say. I don't know that cutting rates by half a point means anything material to most of our lives most of the time. I mean, if we've still got a job, we get cheaper mortgages, but nothing else happens. But as a society, we kind of feel better knowing that someone's out there, you know, like Superman in the red cape, right? They're kind of doing something so we can relax because someone's got it under control. Either way, to be able to cut rates, you need to have rates that are high enough to give you room to cut. Yeah. I mean, they can physically go negative, which is a whole different conversation. But pretty broadly, you want to have rates high enough that you can cut them meaningfully, but still to a level that's above zero and has something, some sort of, you know, heft left, right? So we know they cut rates really hard during the GFC, quite a long way, quite quickly. Different circumstances now. But yeah, I agree with you. I don't want to be critical of the RBA. Morgan Housel, who was an ex-Motley Fool employee who now does his own thing with the Collaborative Fund, said once that, I think he was talking about one of the central bankers. I can't remember who it was. It may have been, who was the most recent one before Powell? Janet Yellen.
Yeah.
Something basically to the extent that, you know, they've forgotten more about central banking than we'll ever know. And so when you start to criticize central bankers because we think we know better, there's a very, very, very good chance that they actually do know better. They might be wrong, but they're coming from a much more solid historical and economic base simply because they've devoted their lives to this stuff. They have access to all the information. So at some level, I don't want to be critical of the RBA. I kind of wish on one level they'd increase rates more quickly when they had the chance. So I'd rather rates be a quarter or half a point higher than they are now. I don't think the economy's in such terrible shape that we need rates this low. But either way, I think holding their fire until I really, as you say, see the data showing something, I think is pretty smart.
You know what? I'm going to vote for RBA.
There you go. Vote one, Philip Lowe.
Unequivocally, that's very easy. I'll vote for RBA.
I'm not sure they're standing, but if they do, they get have my your vote. Yeah. There we go. Not the Motley Fool Party?
I'd vote for the RBA.
Oh,
the RBA is doing an awesome job.
You're killing me here.
Yeah, you know, you've got to give credit to people who are doing a good job, and they're doing a good job, you know. Oh. A pat on the back for them.
Well, you mentioned good jobs. We're about to go from the sublime to, well, a whole lot worse.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Speaking of a whole lot worse, three little letters, mate. B, O, and Q. It's not bugger off quickly. It's the Bank of Queensland. Although it may well have been exactly that because the numbers weren't pretty. Look, we've talked for a little while and we'll talk for a little bit longer about what's going on with banking more broadly. But good old BOQ, Bank of Queensland, really. So here's a paragraph from the AFR. The reporter was James Ayres, is his name. And so he wrote, I'll read a little bit of it. BOQ said its cash earnings were down, its interest margin was tighter, its cost-to-income ratio was up, its earnings per share was down, income was down, its quality capital levels were lower, the loan impairment expense was higher, and its return on equity had fallen by more than a percentage point.
He could have just said everything was bad.
Then he said, it has also cut its interim dividend, as the regional bank's acting boss to the Royal Commission would result in higher costs. That is as damning a paragraph and a bit as I think I've ever read.
Yeah.
They're not the first company to get into trouble. So to be fair, I'm not suggesting that these guys are in worse shape or have a worse performance than any other company ever before. But gee, when you write it like that, that's a tour de force of just ugliness, right? Yeah. So I don't even know where to start. I mean, let's do a couple of big ones. So firstly, let's get the regulatory stuff out of the way. The bank's blaming the Royal Commission, saying, well, because those Royal Commission costs are higher. That's probably, objectively true because there are more costs, both in terms of the work they had to do, frankly, in case they were called for the Royal Commission, the change they're going to have to make as a result. Now, whether you blame the Commission or, frankly, you blame the fact the banks were too light on costs previously and not doing the right jobs in the first place, it's hard to say, well, they made us do the right thing. It's their fault. It's like, well, you should have done the right thing in the first place. So we'll give them half a mark for the fact that that is a genuine cost impost they're going to have to bear. Now, the market probably could have expected it. Certainly, the bank should have. Let's go to some of the bigger issues, though. So, and frankly, if you're not a BOQ shareholder, stick with us because this impacts not only BOQ but also the rest of the banks. And because our banks are around a third or 40% of the market, it kind of impacts the whole ASX. So, just stick with us for a second. The interest margin was tighter. Now, this is the so-called, for those who watch or read a little bit of financial television or radio here, you have the NIMS or the NIM, the net interest margin. Difference between the cost of the funds and the price they're selling them for. Effectively, it's gross margin in anyone else's language, right? If you buy inventory for $20, you sell it for $30, your gross margin is $10, that difference between the two. Banks will borrow money at, pick some numbers, 2%, lend it at 3.5%. The net interest margin is 1.5% or 150 basis points. That's the net interest margin. You want that either holding or growing because otherwise you're making less gross margin and that hurts right through the P&L. BOQ can't do it, mate. What's going on?
Well, number one, we should remember that BOQ is a regional bank. So I think regional banks have more.
We're not just bagging Queenslanders here, are we?
No. We have lots of colleagues in Queensland.
Shout out to our favorite Maroons. Yeah. There aren't many of them because we're Blues supporters, but there's a few Maroons we like.
And then their clock doesn't move and all those things. So, I mean, that's a completely different ballgame.
Well, they don't have faded curtains like us.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a start.
So, anyways, this is not a Queensland specific problem.
No, it's not.
It's just the fact that, you know, as a regional bank, their cost of borrowing is higher, then, you know, effectively, like, our big banks can go to the bond markets. So bond markets basically mean, you know, borrow money overseas very easily and borrow at a pretty good rate, right? People would demand a higher rate from somebody like BOQ.
Because they're smaller, more regional, more concentrated,
you know, they might have more exposure to, you know, certain types of loans that might
be... rating, I think, which is kind of the base reason.
Yeah. So the credit rating would be lower, maybe because of the type of loans they have. You know, the loan book is not viewed as maybe as high quality. Could be just as high quality. Again, I don't know anything about the loan book to make a comment. But
sure.
So I think that plays a big role, right? But the other larger picture is, I mean, we are, you know, we are going from cheap money to at least less cheap or more expensive, however you want to call
it. That's how I put it, yes.
So that is not a good, you know, place to be, right? Combine that with, you know, record high property prices, right? Mm-hmm. So there's less room for growth there. There's, you know, pressure in the, you know, the borrowing costs. It's not a good place for a banker to be.
Very true.
Add to that, as you said, you know, regulatory cost, whatever it is. I mean, you know, whether they were supposed to have it in the past or now, but they do have it now. They didn't have it in the past because they, you know, decided they didn't need it. So it's not a happy combination. I think if anything, I'd say that, you know, population growth is still going to be there, right? And our cities are very desirable. So there's a lot of population growth happening.
Yes.
Which means there's going to be, you know, there's going to be buildings and construction, and there's going to be loans taken out for businesses and homes and, you know, and people, maybe the investing, people investing in property has gone down relatively recently. Maybe it'll pick up again.
Yep.
So, yeah, I don't think it's like dire, but, you know, like banks...
It's not pretty, though.
It's not pretty, but it's like cyclic, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, they're at the cycle. They're probably, you know, past the peak.
Maybe we didn't have cycles. We got 28 years without the recession.
Yeah, but, you know...
This is growth right until, you know, second start of the right and until moment.
Yeah, but maybe, you know, maybe it's like, it's the realization that we are maybe entering a phase of, you know, not so much growth and, you know, little growth and maybe... and that's basically what the interim CEO is basically saying, that, you know, and the cost of capital also, you have to realize, right? So the amount of capital that they have to, essentially the amount of money that the shareholders have to foot to ensure that the books are, you know, all good and within the capital requirements of ARPA has also gone up, right?
Yep.
So that's you know, in a way, it's a good thing, right? Because overall, it basically means that our banks are going to be better. And, you know, in the event of some financial distress, you know, our banks are not going to, you know,
collapse
and run dry.
We
we'd love that. And this is all good in that sense. So I think, you know, so they are taking a lot of costs, so to say, but I think it's costs that... and being a regulated business such as banking, you know, they have an indirect obligation to society, right? So that's the cost of doing business in a regulated industry, a heavily regulated industry, is that, you know, there are these costs and they have to bear that cost.
Right. So They do. It's going to be an ugly, ugly future. Also, the cost to income ratio is up. That kind of makes sense, right? When your income's down, unless your costs fall further, your cost to income ratio goes up. And again, if you think about this, banks are funny businesses, mate. I mean, if you've been a bank shareholder for years and you're used to reading bank financial statements, this stuff's all second nature. I kind of feel like most people own some banks, of course, but also general kind of commercial manufacturing / retail businesses are easier to understand. So if you think about cost to income ratio, what you're pretty much saying is all that gross margin we just talked about, the net interest margin, as the banks like to call it, you think of all your costs below that, and it would normally be your marketing costs and your staff costs and your admin costs and the photocopier and the company cars and all that stuff. Those costs, in theory, if you're growing, if you're running a good business and you can afford to, and you're in a good position brand-wise or frankly with your competitive advantages, you can normally grow your sales faster than your costs. And that means you've got growing net profit margins. So not only is your volume up, but the dollars you make per unit sold, per widget, to use the official term that accountants and economics teachers like to use, for every widget you make, you're making more cents per widget, right? Which means you're doubling your benefit because your volume's up, the amount of money you make per unit are up. That compounds really nicely. The reverse, though, unfortunately, happens more often than not, because it's very, very, very hard to cut costs fast enough to offset falling, in this case, net interest margins and frankly, property prices falling, right? So you've got the combination, again, of the units. In this case, they're lending dollars, so dollars are their inventory. Dollars are going down because they're lending less. They're making less money per dollar lent because they have to pay more for the debt they're getting from overseas. That combination is kind of a bit ugly, right? Because you simply can't sack enough people, close enough branches, shut down enough data centers, do all that kind of stuff quickly enough to offset the falling money coming in the front door.
I think I have a comment on that one. I think what I think is happening here is that they're not embracing technology fast enough.
Right.
And if they had embraced technology fast enough, I think they're good at, you know, banks are very good at adopting technology, you know, at the level of the consumer. But
yeah, because Australia's banks, at a consumer-facing level, Australia's banks are among the fastest in the world, right?
Yeah, like, you know, the highest, for example, one of the highest penetrations of Apple Pay is in Australia, not in the US.
PayWave, right? Tap and Go, that terminal technology.
Yeah, but I think they're not doing that same thing at the banking level, right? I think maybe if they are, you know, they use technology more intelligently, maybe more proactively inside the banks.
More bitcoins.
More bitcoins. What could go wrong? I think maybe that's an area that, you know, there maybe there are some short-term costs, but that could actually, you know, like, I mean, why aren't there, you know, they should have more like online banking and, you know, basically not have, most of the lending could, for example, be done online. That should reduce, in theory, some costs, right?
I think what I hear you saying is they should be sacking more people and replacing them with computers. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm just saying that the banks need to be more efficient. And I think, you know, a lot of those people, if they sack people, if, you know, either they get redeployed elsewhere or those people find different jobs, right? Yeah, I mean, you know, that always happens in an economy. So.
No, I think that's fair. You've touched on a point. So we're going to talk about broadly the banking sector more generally. You've kind of taken us there anyway, which is great. I think investors and, frankly, bank staff, I'm sad to say for those people, really need to get ready for the next wave of bank branch closures. I think to your point about technology, the most obviously under... what's under efficient? Basically, branches aren't what they used to be. If you've been to a branch recently, you're not going with wads of cash, handing them over across a bulletproof glass desk and then having someone count it out and give it back. You're going in, you're sitting on a nice little couch, you're talking to someone who looks at the computer screen and says, yes, here's the product for you or the loan you need or whatever it is. I think you're going to find that there are simply too many of those branches, and they're okay while sales have been growing or while income has been growing because you can kind of cover those costs. I just, if you look around and think, man, how much value is genuinely being created? And I'm sure those people are working hard, and I'm sure their customers are happy that they're there, and I get all that. So this is not a value judgment on the people. But from an organizational perspective, a bank CEO has got to be looking around saying, hey, if we close down a third of our branches, maybe people have got to travel another suburb or two for the very, very occasional in-branch transaction. I think I've been to a branch, I've been with my mother-in-law once, I think, in the last year on my own account. I don't remember the last time I was in a branch. It would have been 4 or 5 years ago, I think.
I have not been, I think, in the last 5-6 years to a branch.
And so that's the reality, right? So I think, unfortunately for those people, look, banks are going to get desperate because top line's going to struggle. And if you can't grow the top line and you're a bank CEO and you want to keep your job, you've got to find cost savings. The branches have got to be in the firing line. We went through a kind of a stream of this, I want to say about 10 years ago now. It could be off by 4 or 5 years, frankly, each side. But there was a big range of closures. There's been a couple in my area that have closed recently. I think we're going to see a heap more branch closures. I would imagine this calendar year or next we'll see another round of closures. And I think once one bank starts, because it's kind of a PR risk, I think those will follow pretty quickly.
Exactly.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, from bank cuts to, well, the house always wins. We're going to talk about, well, that was a bit of a pun, right? So wins, let's think about Wynn Resorts. And for those who don't know Wynn Resorts, one of the largest and most successful casino operators in the US, helmed by Steve Wynn, the man who started the business, who stepped back from executive management but still owns and controls the company, lobbed a bid, or at least started discussions, to take over James Packer's Crown Resorts. Mm-hmm. Now, this was all under the cover of, darkness, but it was all done in secrecy, in confidential terms. They had a bit of a chat. They talked about, you know, how the deal might get done, some cash, some Wynn shares. Apparently, Packer was open to the conversation. And then the story broke in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And as is required, and don't rant on me just yet. I'll give you a chance to rant in a minute. As is required by the continuous disclosure requirements of the ASX, the company was kind of forced to come out and respond to the media reports. And we've been talking to them and here's the details. And then Steve Wynn, or at least Wynn as a company, kind of got the irrits and decided that, well, if you guys want to talk about this out of school, this was supposed to be confidential. The fact it's not confidential anymore, well, we're out. We're taking our bat and ball, our big checkbook. We're going home. You guys, bad luck. You've lost us. That's kind of a whole range of kind of complicated components there, mate. Firstly, I don't know about you. I didn't imagine James Packer being prepared to sell out of his effectively only public market investment. His company owns 46% of Crown, I want to say. He's kind of stepping back and would have been stepping back and walking away. And Steve Wynn, frankly, Crown may have been rebranded Wynn, or maybe they took the Crown brand into Vegas or somewhere else and made it another brand in the casino empire. I'm kind of a bit surprised, firstly, that Packer was prepared to sell. Secondly, it seems a bit churlish of Steve Wynn to say, well, because you made it public, we're walking away.
So I don't know about you, but you know, $4.6 billion was, I think, what was, would have been the payday.
It's a lot of money.
I would take it.
I would take it too. Yes.
So maybe James Packer thought he would take it too.
Well, that's the thing, right? The deal was going to go ahead,
but he has stepped back, right, from active management and involvement, right?
Mm.
So yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's $4.6 billion is a lot of money. So that's that. I think I have a view of continuous disclosures. I think the continuous disclosure thing, in this particular case, for example, they probably wanted to continue with the discussions in confidence until there was a formal offer,
right,
or a more firm offer, which would then have to be disclosed to the market, right? And I think the view that they took was this being disclosed early on basically means that they're trying to encourage other, you know, other bidders, maybe try to bid up the price, you know, trying to see what the other.
So you reckon there's a bit of deliberate kind of leaking here from Crown potentially?
Well, I'm not saying that. I think, you know, that might be their view. It could just be that somebody lower down the chain basically leaked it to the AFR, right? Or leaked it somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, news does get leaked, right?
It does.
And I mean, it is a reporter's job to find news.
Yes.
And they're good at it.
True.
So
people are prepared to talk from what we find out.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's not necessarily the reporter's fault in any way or the newspaper's fault in any way, right? There's a newspaper's job to find
news. Yeah,
they're reporting the news. Sure. So I think the continuous disclosure, though, I mean, once it leaked, then I get the continuous disclosure comes into play, and therefore they had to disclose. I mean, I'm not personally a fan of the continuous disclosure, because I think the continuous disclosure basically means that there's like a drip feed news. Like to me, many companies look like they're on intravenous fluids all the time.
Yep.
They're always releasing a little bit of information because they're always scared.
Oh, here's the rant.
And they're always scared that, you know, they're going to get into trouble. and it's like for investors, it's like, okay, well, you told me that deal happened. Oh, this deed happened. You know, just, you know, we understand a business is always going to, at least I think that a business is always going to have deals happening, right? And, you know, a business is supposed to be in the business of doing business, because if it's not doing business, if it's not doing business, there's a big problem. So I don't want to know, you know, come back to me in like, you know, in 6 months time, right? Yep. You know, continuous disclosure is actually worse than quarterly reporting. Like, I mean, you know, it's
fighting words.
It's really, really bad.
Okay.
In my books. And it's just,
me why.
It's just, you know, it's, I think a company, especially many of the smaller companies, you think about the smaller companies we've got on the ASX, you know, some of them are like $50 million in market cap. Some of them are like $20 million in market cap.
Mm-hmm.
How can they afford to actually continuously disclose information, have that, you know, disclosure arrangements, have the people to do that, you know, all the things that you need to do to actually make sure that you're releasing the information, you're doing it correctly.
Mm.
Why not instead? And many of these companies actually have a hard time trying to just get their books right during the, you know, the report, they, you know, they put their financials out on it. Oh, there was a mistake. Or then they put their financials out. Oh, there was another mistake. And then again, release it, right? So if you can't get your books out properly during the half year, what's the point of this, right? I think what I would rather have is that every half year sounds like a good, you know, space. Mm-hmm. Every 6 months, you're telling me what you're doing, you know, and that, you know, disclose the big deals that you've made or big, you know, movements that has happened as a business, and you know, that's great. Mm. You know, otherwise, if you're going to release information, I would say that release information without financials. So, like, you know, you signed a big client, sure. Say I've signed a big client.
Mm.
Right? Don't delete. You know, again, don't release the financials there. Right? I don't know. I just find it that it just makes it really hard for investors. And there's a lot of speculation that goes on. There's a lot of trading that happens around those news items. There's a lot of probably leaking that happens around those news. So again, I just find it's not that helpful.
Mm. I will half agree with you. I think we may have talked about this before. Here's the thing. I think the rules around continuous disclosure are supposed to make sure that the market is fully informed at all times. And what it's designed to stop is people with some information that isn't publicly available being able to buy or sell shares effectively with an uninformed or a partially informed market. So if I was to know that The Motley Fool is not a public company, so we'll talk about it. If The Motley Fool was going to launch a great new product next week and I knew it was coming and it was going to double our revenues, I could buy shares today. The service starts tomorrow or next week, and then sales double, profits quadruple, and I make $1 squillion to sell my shares in 3 weeks' time. Under that sort of scenario, the rules about the continuous disclosure are supposed to require that I probably internally, if I knew that information, I shouldn't trade anyway, but that's kind of the point, that the market at least as fully informed as it can be about what the material events that are impacting a company are and how the market should think about them. So that's the positive. Now, like everything, there's always side effects, there's always negative outcomes and all that kind of stuff. I think that's what you're talking about now.
So insider trading though, right? That's what you're explaining is insider trading. That is basically legal.
But that's the idea. Right. The idea of continuous disclosure is supposed to be to minimize the chance of any of that happening, and particularly second and third-hand information, right? So I tell my wife, she tells her tennis coach, he tells his wife, she tells, you know what, at some point, any information that's out there in the public that is a partially informed market, that's the idea of continuous disclosure in the first place, is to make sure the market is as fully informed as possible at all times so that there is that minimizes the chance of, you know, being able to trade inside information. So the fact that effectively, continuous disclosure is an adjunct to the insider trading rules to make sure that they are as enforceable and, frankly, as unlikely to be required, because insider trading is so incredibly difficult to demonstrate at any particular point in time. It's also supposed to stop things like analyst briefings being given to some people and not somebody else. So in the US, they have Reg FD, fair disclosure, they call it. Same kind of idea is you can't just say to your mates at Investment Bank 1, 2, and 3, hey, here's what we're doing, here's what's coming up, here's the most recent set of numbers. That's not insider trading because you're sharing it with the community. At one point, it was actually completely legal to do that, right? You could simply tell people whenever you wanted, whatever you wanted, and there was no obligation to tell everybody at the same time. So the broad idea is that if there's information out there, it must be released to everybody at the same time on a public platform rather than selectively disclosed to certain people.
My point would be that, you know, the problem with any of these things trying to, you know, block insider trading, if the goal is to do stop insider trading, I think the insider trading can still happen because, you know, people could just trade before the news has been released.
What about selective disclosure, though?
So I think, you know, again, in terms of selective disclosure, I think instead of the companies announcing every deal that they think is meaningful,
yep,
they could just wait until, so non-disclosure and have inside company rules that basically say that, look, if you are privy to information that is important and market moving, and you know, here's the other thing, right? Like people who work, for example, in big public companies, they're working on projects, they know stuff, but you know what most people will tell you, that it's very hard to actually act on that information and actually make money because, you know, most of the time you actually don't know enough to use it to your advantage, right? So in most cases, the information that is really pertinent to make actually informed trading, that you actually can make some money, is relatively held by a relatively small number of people, which basically means that it's basically held, you know, at the C-suite level or you know, just somewhere just below that, you know. But I think those people should be under higher scrutiny anyways, and their share buying back, you know. So we have disclosures about their share buying back, right? So we could always go back to, you know, if an executive buys shares, that's disclosed to market, and then later on, you know, we figure out there's an announcement, well, we can re-link it back. Right. So I think that, you know, it's harder for them to do such stuff. But that's what I think. But anyways, I know I'm in the minority.
I think you're right. I mean, that is the, every action has a consequence, right? And so the regulator's job is to try and provide as much, well, the best possible regulatory environment, which minimizes the compliance cost, maximizes the public benefit. And whether they get it right or wrong, that's always an open debate. I think it's a worthwhile conversation, right? At some level, they have to say, well, if I make companies do this thing, does that improve or reduce the ability of the market to trade in an informed and efficient way? Currently, the continuous disclosure rules are their best guess at getting that resolved. I think net-net, I'm still in favor of them rather than against them. I think it's better than not. Quite frankly, I have a much bigger issue with companies putting out pumpy press releases that are kind of ASX releases that are thinly disguised press releases saying how wonderful they are, right? I think if we change anything, they would do that anyway. That's the other thing, right? They don't need to be forced to do that. If they can put out a press release saying, guess what? We just signed up 84,000 customers and we're going to be trillionaires tomorrow. To the extent they can or do or want to do that, they're not compelled to do that because they're trying to pump the share prices. Probably I can say that because I'm not naming individual companies, so I'm not going to get sued by anybody. There is a lot, particularly at the smaller end of the market, as you say, mate, a lot of, I wouldn't even call it necessary market manipulation, but it's way, way, way over the top. Press releases that are designed to get the share price higher, almost as the goal, rather than as a desire to inform the market and keep the market, you know, knowing what's going on.
Cool.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, we're going to finish up with the Fool Mailbag. We have one question, and we've got a bit of an announcement in a minute, but we'll finish off with a question first. From Vallabhav Mehutra. Sorry, my apologies, Vallabhav, if I've pronounced your name badly, which I'm almost certain that I have. My apologies. He says, hey, what's your view on ETFs? Also, is it advisable to switch super funds? Any drawbacks of switching them? I'm new to super staff, and with REST, which is the Retail Employees Super Trust, I think, at the moment, not sure if I should be happy with the REST performance in September 2015. That's a pretty good question. So let's take them in separate parts. Let's talk about ETFs first. We've mentioned ETFs a few times, mate. So just broadly, and can you give me the... So here's the thing about ETFs that I think we kind of assume, right? People say ETFs, most of us think of a proxy for an index, right? So an ASX 200 ETF is what we think. We think broad market index fund. That's kind of what we're led to believe. Now, in the US, there are more ETFs than stocks now because anything can be an ETF. You and I could put together the Doc and Scott managed ETF, list it tomorrow, and it would simply be a vehicle for a managed fund, which is completely appropriate, by the way. I'm not saying that as a bad thing, but that's not exactly an index, low-cost index ETF either, right? So what is an ETF and what are the different types of ETFs out there?
Okay, so ETF basically stands for Exchange Traded Fund.
Right.
And it's a proxy essentially for holding multiple stocks.
I'm going to guess that's a fund traded on an exchange,
right? Yeah, it's basically a fund. So it's a way of holding multiple stocks in different proportions.
Yes.
Using one ticker or one instrument and buying it and selling it, right? So it provides a platform. So basically ETF on the market basically means you can buy something like an index, for example, as you said, all in one transaction without actually buying the individual company.
So you could already do that with a managed fund, right? But it was off market. So back in the very first ETF was, or the very first index fund, I should say, was Vanguard way back in the day. And they said, we will buy all the bits and pieces of the market in proportion.
Yeah.
Send us a check. And we'll give you a unit in the managed fund. And that was all done, not behind closed doors, because that sounds bad, but it wasn't done on an exchange-traded market. There was no way to buy and sell without writing the company saying, can you please send me a check with my money back, please?
Yeah.
The ETF move was to take that managed fund idea and let you simply buy and sell it on an exchange as you would with any other stock, right?
Yeah. So with the managed fund, for example, there might be, you know, some managed funds will allow you to exit on a weekly basis,
right?
So they're going to be weekly pricing. Some give you a daily pricing.
That's kind of a hassle because I've got my Comstock account already. I can just buy and sell, like I buy and sell BHP or Commonwealth Bank or Telstra.
And the money would show up into your bank account, right? Here in you can buy it on your brokerage and you have a price, a bid and an ask every moment. And therefore it's very liquid in that sense,
right?
So that's the biggest advantage. One of the biggest advantages is that basically it's a liquid way of accessing funds.
So it's a managed fund on the market.
It's a managed fund on the market, right? Now, there are different types. One, the biggest one that we talk about is the index funds, right? So there's the ASX 200, which basically is mimicking the performance of the top 200 companies on the ASX.
Right.
Or it mimics, actually, to be more specific, it typically would be an S&P ASX 200 list, right? So S&P and ASX together make this list of the top 200 largest companies and then decide what the market caps is and then proportionally weight it.
Yep.
Right?
So BHP is 10% of the ASX 200 index.
Yeah.
And so it'd be 10% of an index tracking ETF.
Exactly. Then you can get similar indices from foreign markets. So on the ASX, for example, you could buy the S&P 500, which is the 500 largest, again, which is the S&P's list of 500 largest companies on the US.
And that's kind of the dominant US market index, right? When someone says, how's the US market going? They say, well, the S&P 500 up 5%.
Exactly.
You can, with Australian dollars, on the ASX with your current brokerage account,
buy
effectively access to mirroring with a little bit taken out for fees, the S&P 500.
Exactly.
Okay.
You could do the same thing for the NASDAQ 100, which is the list of the 100 ex-financials companies on the NASDAQ, right?
Largely tech-heavy, kind of Googles, Apples, Amazons.
Yeah, I mean, you've got some Coca-Cola. Facebook. I think you've got like Pepsi there, for example.
You do have Pepsi on there, actually, yeah.
So that's why I said ex-financials. I mean, it is tech-heavy, but it's, you know.
It's not pure tech.
It's not pure tech. So that's that. So those are the indices. And you can do the same thing. You could buy, like, you know, Korea. You could buy Europe. You could buy Europe 50, you could buy the, you know, then you can get esoteric, right? You can buy, for example, things like the largest 100 companies of the world.
Okay.
Right. Again, right here on the ASX, you'd be a mix of stuff from Japan and Europe and
world. Shell and GlaxoSmithKline and Pfizer and Swatch.
All those sort of things.
Nice.
Then you could get more esoteric and you could say, okay, I want to buy a particular sector. So again, there are sector ETFs, right? So you could buy a tech sector ETF, which could be, again, country-specific or could be world-specific or could be region-specific. You could buy things like, you know, biotech. You could buy technology. You could buy telecommunications. You could buy...
And here's what gets a bit messy, right? Because if you buy, say, a tech ETF, you're not necessarily getting index-weighted exposure at low cost. In some cases, you're getting some manager somewhere is charging you potentially a pretty penny to pick his own tech stocks and brawling him into a fund, right? So yes, it's on that theme, but there's no obligation for it to be necessarily index weighted.
No, so I'll just chip in a little bit there.
Definitely.
So I think there are two types there. So you could buy, say, an S&P tech ETF. So
right.
The S&P being the Standard and Poor's.
Yes.
They've made a tech ETF. Or a tech index,
right.
And then somebody's basically running it and basically taking a fee. That I would still call it as passive.
Yes.
It's not active in the sense that somebody else is making it. It's, you know, doesn't things don't change that often.
So you get exposure to the largest tech companies weighted by market cap.
Yeah.
Effectively, like you would if you're buying the S&P 500 index.
Yeah, so you could buy, you know, like you could buy a mining index, for example, right? You could buy mining, you can buy gold miners, you can buy all sorts of things.
Relatively low fee because it's passive.
It's passive.
In other words,
there's
not, right. And difference passive and active for our listeners. Passive is when no manager adds their own mental effort to it. They just exactly. Simply say, buy it in the proportion that the index is already set. And they simply do that. And just, you know, there's a trader at a desk somewhere who probably algorithm these days, but who would increase and decrease the number of positions based on how much money is flowing in and out of the fund.
Yeah. Then you get to sort of indices which are a little bit more specialized where you're looking at, you know, some combination of, say, sector and valuation.
Okay.
Right.
So this is where either a manager making arbitrary calls or relying on a formula they've already predetermined.
Exactly.
To change. And this is where it kind of gets a bit blurred, right? Because those
exactly.
are higher fee.
Yeah.
Hopefully higher return, because otherwise the manager's not earning his money. That's where it gets a little bit messy, right? A little bit tricky.
A little bit. In a way, it becomes like stock picking, but maybe on a group of stocks, right? So, I mean, you know, like there are good and bad things, right? I mean, so you need to know exactly how the index or the ETF actually works or what the ETF's constituents are and how they're actually picked. If you understand that, then you can maybe make some broad theme-based decisions, right? So if somebody mm-hmm. wanted to invest, say, for example, in tech, which is, you know, Moti, but, you know, and value, there are mm-hmm. ETFs that allow you to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
If you wanted to invest in Asia and tech, there are ETFs that allow you to do that, right? If you wanted to just have exposure to mm-hmm. S&P 500 or the ASX 200, you can do that. So I think it becomes... in a way, it becomes a lot like stock picking, right? And
right, because you start the more active you try and be, the greater the chance your results are going to diverge from the index.
And
so, for us, generally speaking, most of the time in Australia, so let me try and phrase it better. In Australia, if we were going to say to people, "Hey, you should think about an ETF," we're normally saying to them, "Look, if you don't want to pick your own stocks, you should at least get the market average return. So buy a super low cost index ETF. That way you'll at least get the return of the ASX 200, for example." And then we might say to people, well, you want some international exposure. So buy a diversified low cost international ETF and get the rest of the world's total result. When you start getting more specific, you're either saying, here's a way to get access to something that isn't on the ASX at all. Or if we very rarely do this, but generally people might say, well, I want to go with a particular manager or a particular strategy that I think is going to be market beating. And I'm going to let that person do it for me.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah. I mean, I'll add just one point that, you know, one interesting thing that one can do with ETFs is, you know, given the large proliferation of ETFs, especially on the, you know, the number of ETFs is increasing rapidly on the ASX as well.
It really is.
Right? One of the things that you could do is it allows you to build diversification into your portfolio.
Yeah.
And it also, you could think of it as like a hedge as well in some sense, because you, mm-hmm. you can, you know, if you think there's, you know, you want to have some exposure that helps you if there are some problems in the local economy, mm-hmm. then that ETF actually is actually better than having cash, right? You can have a hedge using cash, but you can also have an ETF that is not correlated to your market that allows you to hedge it. So, I mean, there are uses of it. I think they're good instruments if you know what you're doing, if you know what fees you're paying. Again, mm-hmm. you know, look at the fees, look at the strategy.
So, Balabab, I hope that helps. We've tried to give you a broad view of ETFs. So, I'll give you my how I would use them, and then Doc can add back in after his thoughts before. Generally speaking, I would say to people, we think you can beat the market by picking stocks. And that's what we do as a job, right? So you'd expect us to say that. And if we're doing our job well, we will achieve that and we're worth our money. If not, well, then frankly, we'd say go and buy the ETF. So part of the answer, honestly, is ETF gives you a broad index ETF, let me be clear, gives you the market return of both either local or an international market or markets, plural. And you can just simply buy those and go fishing, go shopping, as we said before, right? So that's a really simple, easy way to do it. On top of that, if you wanted to, you could then say, well, I want that diversification to Doc's point. I want to get exposure to, say, tech companies that aren't in Australia. We don't have a very big tech sector. You can buy an international tech ETF and do that. You could say, well, my job's in Australia. My house is in Australia. My income's, you know, my portfolio's in Australia. I want some international exposure just because it makes sense to be diversified. I'm going to get international exposure using a broad index ETF. generally speaking, I'll speak for myself, Doc, I would steer away from an actively managed ETF because the fees are going to be higher, and because unless you know that manager is going to beat the market, you're taking that stock-specific risk that Doc talked about, the stock-picking risk that Doc talked about. And if you're paying a fixed fee, or sorry, percentages to get that, that's what starts to get a little bit dicey for me. You might as well buy the index, right? Unless you know that manager is going to be able to beat the market consistently. So that's something just to be a little bit careful of. And then secondly, just be, you know, again, do you really need that access? Do you really need that exposure? There's high-yield funds on the ASX, for example, that are using options and stuff to try and deliver higher income than bank dividends, and there's a whole lot of other stuff around. Managers try and dress up these things because they think they might be exciting and fun, and they want you to throw them some money. And hey, if you genuinely think that's the right way to invest, then we would say go for it, right? But just be a little bit careful about how you invest that money, just to make sure you're not getting taken for a ride. Basically, it's exciting and it's fun and it's interesting, but if you're not going to beat the market, buy the market. That's the bottom line, I think, when it comes to ETFs. Buying the market means buying a broad-based, very low-cost index ETF, a Vanguard ETF are the ones I prefer, just because they're a not-for-profit company, meaning that there's every chance the funds will be as low as they possibly can be. You're not lining in else's pocket with profit. Not that we don't like profits, but there's no point paying costs. You don't have to. How'd I go, Doc?
I think I agree with you. I think that hits all the basic points.
Now, we're going to keep the second half of the question, mate, because we're out of time. But yeah, next cool. week, fools, stay tuned, because we've got a special Good Friday edition. No, Doc and I aren't going to drag our backsides in here next Friday. We're going to record it in about a minute's time. Mm-hmm. But next week, it'll be released. So hopefully, by the time you're listening to our next podcast, it will be Good Friday, and we'll give you some Easter holiday listening. But for now, that wraps us up. Before we go, don't forget you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast, and we hope you will, through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a big rating on iTunes. Tell your friends, leave us a review. The more ears that hear, the more people that can know, hopefully, the better they can invest. And that's what we're here for after all. And don't forget, you can get a little bit of foolishness straight to your inbox now by going to fool.com.au/Triple M.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/triple M. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.